Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Secretary of State in Paris for latest talks on ISIS. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is joining foreign ministers from European and Arab nations Monday in Paris for the latest talks on the battle against Islamic State and efforts to foster a political resolution to the situation in Syria. Diplomats are trying to build momentum for a meeting Friday in New York that would include U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. They want a foundation for a ceasefire and political process based on an international agreement last month in Vienna to launch peace talks by January 1st. Earlier today in Damascus, Stephen O'Brien, who is the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, made this announcement.
The United Nations and our partners have just finalized the humanitarian response plan for 2016. We need $3.2 billion to help 13.5 million Syrians who require some form of assistance. Some 6.5 million of them are internally displaced. 72% of the population have no access to drinking water. And 2 million children are out of school. This situation is unacceptable. A blot on our collective conscience.
The UN humanitarian chief made the announcement on Monday in Damascus on the last day of a three-day mission to Syria. Meanwhile, in Syria, dozens are reported killed following a heavy bombardment of mortar shells in the opposition-held eastern Ghouta region near Damascus. The London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says airstrikes struck the town of Douma, killing and wounding dozens, including children. This is VOA News. President Obama goes to the Pentagon today to chair a National Security Council meeting on U.S. efforts to fight Islamic State. A White House statement said the president will receive an update from his national security team and discuss ways to further enhance the U.S. campaign to degrade and destroy the terrorist group. President Obama is due to make a statement to reporters after the talks. Egypt Monday said its investigators found no evidence of terrorism in the October 31st crash of a Russian plane in the Sinai Peninsula that killed 224 people. However, Russia and the West have said an explosive device placed on board the Airbus plane brought it down. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility. The Metrojet flight took off from the popular Sharm el-Sheikh resort area, and the crash has affected tourism, with both Russia and Britain responding by suspending flights to Egypt. Deadly clashes Saturday into Sunday between soldiers and members of a pro-Iranian Islamic group have left at least 12 people dead and dozens wounded in the northeast Nigerian city of Zaria. The army says hundreds of followers of the Islamic movement of Nigerian leader Ibrahim Zazaki barricaded roads blocking an army convoy containing the army chief of staff. It says the crowd had dangerous weapons and failed to disperse. At least two people were killed and several wounded Sunday in the Central African Republic as voters cast ballots on a new constitution 2 weeks ahead of delayed presidential and legislative elections aimed at ending 3 years of chaos. Threats of violence kept many away from the polls. Exit polls in France are projecting that voters decisively have rejected the country's anti-immigrant far-right National Front in Sunday's legal regional runoff elections. The National Front topped voting in six of the country's 13 regions in the first round of elections a week ago, but the exit polls showed former President Nicolas Sarkozy and his allies were the clear winners in the second round. The Hudson Institute's Ben Haddad is not surprised by the result.
The moment when the socialists decided to withdraw their lists from the second round and support the center-right conservative, the Republicans, Sarkozy's political party, it was clear that it would be very complicated for the National Front to win any of the region, to get an absolute majority. The conservatives won most of the regions where the National Front had the chance, but I mean, it's still clearly a warning for the French political establishment that the National Front to get more than 40%. This is unprecedented in French politics.
National Front leader Marine Le Pen had hoped a victory Sunday would serve as a springboard to launch a 2017 presidential bid against Mr. Sarkozy and the country's socialist president, François Hollande. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
At least 87 people were killed over the weekend in Burundi's capital after armed men attacked three military bases. It was the worst violence since a failed coup in May and has led to intensified calls for dialogue and regional mediation.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from our East Africa Bureau in Nairobi. Details next. Also in the news, a new initiative is being launched to bring education to more than 700,000 children affected by conflict or forced displacement in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. And South Africa's president has replaced the finance minister for a second time in the past week. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Zambia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Burundi's Prosecutor General has asked for the extradition of four Burundi radio and TV journalists now in Rwanda. And over the weekend, at least 87 people were killed in Burundi's capital after armed men attacked three military bases. It was the worst violence since a failed coup in May and has led to intensified calls for dialogue and regional mediation. Mohamed Yusuf has more from our East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
Some normalcy has returned to the capital since the fighting began Friday. Security forces fought off assaults on three army bases from as of yet unidentified armed men. Witnesses say security forces then rounded up youths in opposition neighborhoods late Friday and Saturday. One witness who did not want his name to be used for fear of reprisal said it was police officers doing house-to-house searches, especially in his area, Nyakabiga. He says they went in, arrested youths, and then killed some of them, saying they're the ones who are against the government. Police deny that allegation. The crisis began in April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced his bid for a third term. Critics say that bid violated the constitution and the Arusha Accords that ended Burundi's civil war. Nkurunziza won re-election in July in a vote boycotted by the opposition. Opposition to the president has grown more violent in recent weeks, and there have been almost daily clashes between armed vigilantes and police. Yolande Bauka is a researcher for Conflict Prevention and Risk Analysis Division of the Institute for Security Studies. She says the latest event in Burundi had a worrying escalation.
People who were initially peaceful protesters, some of them have been radicalized or maybe feel like there's no political avenue to see any real change in Burundi. But it's definitely a clear sense that things are changing. That being said, I think it needs to be clear that there remains a great deal of people who remain peacefully opposed to President Nkurunziza's third mandate.
Efforts at international mediation or domestic political dialogue appear stalled.
The lack of political dialogue between the opposition groups and between the ruling party have made it possible for individuals seeking to recruit young people to engage in violent action against the state easier. And unfortunately, what we see is a clear sign that the East African community has not been able to mediate the situation in Burundi. In fact, it's going towards the direction of a civil war if we don't intervene.
Security forces have increased their presence in the capital, searching for weapons and youths they suspect to be involved in protests and armed groups. Police spokesman Pierre Nkurukiye told VOA Monday that operation is ongoing.
In the city, the police are continuing to secure people and the property. Police is doing its daily job.
Human rights groups have accused security forces and militia allied to the ruling party of abuses against civilians and protesters, an accusation denied by the Burundi government. In a tweet Sunday, US Secretary of State John Kerry called for dialogue and said the killing must end, including, he said, the disproportionate response by security forces. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Washington-based humanitarian group Refugees International said today it is concerned about claims from Burundian refugees in Rwanda who said they have been recruited by armed groups in Burundi. Rwanda is hosting nearly one-third of the refugees, including 45,000, at its Mahama camp. Refugees International's report cites international officials who describe recruitment efforts at Mahama mainly targeting adult men, but some cases involving children between the ages of 15 and 17. The report says those who decline to join the armed groups face harassment. Refugees International is calling on Rwanda to ensure any recruitment is immediately stopped and to publicly affirm that such efforts violate the country's law and international law. It also wants the United Nations and African Union to impose sanctions against anyone violating the civilian and humanitarian character of asylum. Nigerian army troops shot and killed members of a Shiite Muslim group during the weekend after the group allegedly attacked the convoy of Nigeria's army chief. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria says soldiers killed up to 300 of its members in the northern city of Zaria in Kaduna State. Other reports put the death toll much lower at 20. Witnesses say the violence began Saturday after members of the movement blocked the highway and stoned the convoy of General Tukur Burtai, an army spokesman called the stoning, an attempt to assassinate the army leader. The Shiite group says there was no assassination attempt and that the army had launched a pre-planned attack on the group. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel calls her country's acceptance of more than a million refugees this year a historic test for Europe. Ms. Merkel defended her leadership role in the humanitarian crisis to an annual conference of her ruling party. She also says the flow of migrants will be reduced. In Greece, the government is scheduled to sign an agreement with the UN Refugee Agency and the European Commission to help provide housing for 20,000 new arrivals in Athens. Another 80,000 migrants are due to be sheltered across Greece and the Balkans, mostly in heated tents. A new initiative is being launched to bring education to more than 700,000 children affected by conflict or forced displacement in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. About half are expected to be children displaced by the war in Syria. The rest are expected to come from Chad, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Sudan, South Sudan, and Uganda, as well as Yemen, Iran, Malaysia, and Pakistan. The project is a joint effort by the Education Above All Foundation and the UN Refugee Agency UNHCR. Dr. Mary Joy Picozzi is director of the foundation's Educate a Child program. From Cairo, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the initiative.
This is actually a follow-on agreement. We have been working with UNHCR since 2012. UNHCR has education presence in most of the places where it works. So we are working with them in the 12 countries that we've agreed on.
Now, of course, you're dealing with more than 700,000 kids. Do you have enough schools or facilities to handle that many at this time, even with the help of UNHCR?
So Educate a Child does not actually operate on the ground. We support our partners. So what we have already done with UNHCR is spent time with them, visited some of their programs on the ground to ensure that they do, in fact, have facilities that make it possible for them to offer a quality education. I use the word facilities because in not every case is it a fancy school like we might see in a place like New York or London, but in fact, it might be a more modest construction, but nevertheless one in which there are trained teachers and there are materials and there are kids that want to learn.
Why is it important to make sure these kids get an education?
Well, I think there are two or three reasons that pop up to really the top of the agenda. We're right on the cusp of the new sustainable development goals that are really looking towards eradicating poverty by 2030, and education is key to that. So we at Educate a Child are committed to the right to education, and obviously we're never going to eradicate poverty or have human development if we don't also invest in education. So that's one of the key reasons why we would do it. I think a second one is that we are committed to focusing first and foremost on the most marginalized children around the world, certainly those who are refugees or internally displaced are among the most disadvantaged. Frequently, they've been uprooted and, in fact, have lost pretty much everything, not only their education. And then this leads to really a third point that I think is important, which is that in addition to providing an education of quality that actually is the foundation for a life of learning, education also can serve as a means of addressing the trauma and kind of sense of return to normality for children who've been uprooted, whose lives have been changed, and who may actually have lost family members. So I would say those are three important reasons for why both we and UNHCR would engage in this.
How much will this program cost?
Our contribution to this particular program is a little over $57 million over a four-year period. The partner has to provide at least half of the cost of the project. So the total project cost is estimated at close to $123 million for all these children over the 12 countries.
Dr. Mary Joy Pigozzi is director of the Educate a Child program from Cairo. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa. You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. At least 87 people were killed over the weekend in Burundi's capital after armed men attacked three military bases. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel calls her country's acceptance of more than a million refugees this year a historic test for Europe. And Nigerian army troops shot and killed members of a Shiite Muslim group during the weekend. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. South Africa's president has replaced the finance minister for a second time in the past week. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Paul reports the move sparked a free fall in South Africa's markets and stirred up political controversy.
South Africa's new finance minister, Praveen Gordhan, who served in the post from 2009 to 2014, joked about how long he expected to stay in his second round at the job after his sudden appointment late Sunday.
I just want to know how long can you expect to hold the position in the finance position? Because it's been quite a rough one. So how long can you expect?
10 minutes from now.
Okay.
Gordhan takes over from little-known MP David Van Rooyen, who was abruptly appointed last week, one day after President Jacob Zuma fired Finance Minister Kgatla Nene. The sudden shakeup hit South Africa's economy as the ailing currency fell further and stock prices plummeted. Van Rooyen, an obscure African National Congress Parliament member with no national experience, did not do much to help the situation when he briefly spoke to media Thursday after his swearing-in, during which he appeared visibly unenthusiastic.
I will endeavor to ensure that every policy is directed at creating favorable investment conditions leading to the development of South Africa for all South Africans, not for the few.
Monday, Gordhan promised he will set the nation back on a course of sound fiscal management, something it badly needs amid falling commodity prices, sky-high unemployment, and increasing political turmoil. Zuma has not said publicly why he replaced the ministers. Nene had been well-regarded and made a name for himself for his opposition to some of the president's proposals, like a plan to buy the president a new private jet. His axing set off a firestorm of controversy and exposed fault lines in the notoriously closed ranks of the ANC, with the former health minister calling for Zuma to resign and more junior party members openly expressing criticism. The nation's opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, accused Zuma of playing Russian roulette with the nation's economy. A spokesman of the nation's far-left Economic Freedom Fighters Party called for Zuma's resignation, adding, "If anyone still does not think we are in a banana republic, they cannot be helped." Gordon noted news of his appointment Sunday has sent the currency in the markets in an upward direction, while public reaction to his reappointment has been largely positive. But this episode has dinged President Zuma and his party ahead of local elections next year. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping force in the Central African Republic says a majority of 2 million voters turned out yesterday to vote on constitutional referendum. The UN estimates 80% of voters went to the polls despite the violence. The large turnout occurred despite what the UN force commander describes as a war zone in some areas of the country. Approval of the draft constitution would pave the way for December 27th polls to elect a new president and parliament. The vote could restore democratic rule in the wake of two successive transitional governments. The Cameroon government has asked farmers not to plant for the coming growing season until the government can assure them there will be sufficient rainfall. Unpredictable weather patterns in recent years have led to long dry seasons and hurt production. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Bamindi in the northwest.
42-year-old Ndukong Kennedy raised chicken in Santa on the outskirts of Bamenda in northwest Cameroon. He abandoned his groundnut farms after late and insufficient rainfall caused the crop to wither for two consecutive years. Rains would usually start here in March.
Finally, the rain came about end of April and the sun was hot and it's fried the groundnut in the farm. We used to prepare our farm during the dry season, expecting rain, knowing that on the 15th of March, we'll have the first rainfall. But nowadays, we don't even know when the rain will come.
Henry Muma Awa, the most senior government official in charge of environment in Bamenda, has asked farmers to not plant in 2016 until he gives the all clear.
There's confusion in the rainfall pattern. We call it a distorted rainfall pattern. Before, we used to know that we have a definite period for dry season and we have a definite period for rainy season. But this time around, it is not very certain. Productivity of some of the crops are dropping because of this distorted pattern of rainfall. The temperatures have gone up because deforestation has gone too high and there's a lot of carbon dioxide shield in the atmosphere.
The African Adaptation Programme of the UN Development Programme reports that average annual temperature in Cameroon has increased a total of 0.7 degrees Celsius since the 1960s. During that same period, average annual rainfall has dropped by 2.2% per decade. Environmentalist Nestor Bouma blames human activity.
More than 80 to 90% of the population uses fuel wood. It pushes the local population to now fell trees, so there is abusive cuts of fuel wood to use in the various households.
Depending on the region, planting would happen from mid-March to June in Cameroon. It is hard to say how many farmers would be affected by calls to delay, but 70% of the country's 22 million people rely on agriculture, many of them subsistence farmers. Cameroon is not reporting any acute food shortages at the moment, but there was a 200,000-ton deficit in cereal production last year. The prices of beans, potato, and maize have climbed 25% in the past 2 years, according to the government, as production in some areas has stagnated. Cameroon President Paul Biya raised concern about decreasing rainfall in his address at the start of the climate change summit that ended Saturday in Paris. Biya said Cameroon is committed to regional reforestation efforts and to reducing its carbon footprint by 32% by 2035. Moki, Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Bamenda.
Despite making up half of the world's overall workforce, women hold only a quarter of the jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math, what are known as the STEM fields. But a program in Indianapolis, Indiana, is working to change that by putting girls in charge of robotic competition. Erica Celeste reports from Perry Meridian High School.
Welcome to Cyber Blue. Like many high school robotics clubs, members work in a studio that's part machine shop, part dueling arena. While the 45-member club is composed of both genders, girls are operating the robots today. That's because they recently created and hosted Indy Rage, or Indianapolis Robotics All-Girls event, a competition in which only girls were allowed to drive the robots. Male club members helped out in the pits, but girls, like senior Elizabeth Bremer, took the leadership positions.
We started this because we thought it was important that girls got into it. Not that they can't when boys are there, but some maybe feel like they can't step up when the guys are doing things.
Like many robotics competitions, the goal was for robots to pick up and deliver objects to a specific area to score points. Meanwhile, other robots tried to prevent scoring. Sophomore Olivia Shake was an operator for the girls' competition.
I felt a lot more stress taken off of me because I was with the girls and I felt like they weren't pressuring me as much as the guys.
CyberBlue first competed in an all-girls event last year in Michigan and did quite well.
Competitions are really fun for us because you get to see other teams' robots and you get to see how they do what they do, and then you kind of get ideas tracking back like, oh, we could have done that.
Sophomore Raven Blakey, who was at the competition, thinks her team's success at the event may be one of the reasons the number of girls in CyberBlue doubled this year from 7 to 13. Lead mentor Chris Foltz, who works for Rolls-Royce as his day job, says the whole point of clubs like CyberBlue is to get students excited about science and engineering and thinking about careers in those industries. To help them toward that goal, students go through a rigorous process to join the team, from filling out applications to creating resumes and being interviewed.
We run like a small business, so the students apply to interviews, and every year they do that. So the students that are returning year after year also go through that process. So several students have told us that after the robotics interviews, their first job interview was a breeze.
Junior Katie Boyce says she wanted nothing to do with the robotics team when she first heard about it, until she realized that members joined sub-teams such as design, electronics, programming, or public relations.
My first year, I got here and I was like, oh, there's other stuff I can do. Like, it's not just about the robot.
Thanks to CyberBlue, Katie now knows she wants to go into public relations, while Olivia wants to work on rocket engines for NASA. Raven might like to design cars, and Elizabeth is considering a career as an engineer. The girls will join their male counterparts for the regular robotics season the first week of January. If all goes well, CyberBlue hopes to compete in the World Championships in St. Louis this spring. And maybe this time, girls will be at the controls again. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Indianapolis, Indiana.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on the Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa,
Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. At least 87 people were killed over the weekend in Burundi's capital after armed men attacked three military bases. And Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel called for her country's acceptance of more than a million refugees this year, a historic test for Europe. And Nigerian army troops shot and killed members of a Shiite Muslim group during the weekend after the group allegedly attacked the convoy of Nigeria's army chief. Coming up, music from Zambia, and in our feature segment, after meeting with the heads of state of more than 50 African countries, India's prime minister discusses ways to improve the continent's health infrastructure. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Yehiyes.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with American soccer.
Yehiyes, if we look at American soccer this year, the biggest highlight was the USA winning its record third Women's World Cup title in July with a 5-2 victory over defending champion Japan in Vancouver, Canada. In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2015, let's take a look back at the Women's World Cup final. The Americans exploded for four goals during the first 16 minutes of the game. USA captain Carly Lloyd was the player of the match and the player of the tournament. She received the Golden Ball Award given to the best player at the Women's World Cup. After some hat trick heroics in Vancouver, Carly scored three goals in the first half, finding the net in the third, fifth, and 16th minutes. Lloyd's third goal was my favorite. She dodged a challenge near the center circle, and near midfield, she noticed Japan's goalkeeper, Ayumi Kaori, was at the top of the penalty box. Lloyd launched a wonder strike as Kaori backpedaled, stumbled, and got a hand on it before watching the spectacular shot touch the post and roll into the net. Hey, Carly, how does it feel to be a World Cup champion?
I don't think it's entirely sunk in. I'm so proud and so zapped at the same time. It's a surreal moment. It's been amazing. I mean, we just wrote history today and brought this World Cup trophy home, which is unbelievable. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that I've pushed on my status a little bit, and I have to stay up here. So it's not right away, but I'll be back to work and back stronger than ever.
As Carly Lloyd said, the USA wrote history with its third Women's World Cup title. The Americans also won the trophy in 1991 and 1999. They also gained a measure of revenge after losing to the Japanese on penalty kicks in the 2011 final. At the post-match news conference, U.S. coach Jill Ellis praised their Asian opponent.
First, I want to congratulate Japan. They are a tremendous opponent and deserving of always ending up in championship matches. Love how they play.
USA coach Jill Ellis talked with Abby Wambach, one of the greatest female soccer players ever, about taking on a different role at this World Cup. The 35-year-old Wambach came off the bench as a second-half substitute in both the semifinals and final. In the end, Wambach celebrated her first World Cup title.
I'm so happy. I'm emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted. I love my teammates. Carly Lloyd, are you kidding me with the effort that she gave today? But really, it was a true team effort. Not only just the 23 players, but our staff. just shows how important every little detail has become.
And speaking of details, let's give a few details now on the award winners at this 7th Women's World Cup in Canada. Carly Lloyd, as I mentioned, won the Golden Ball Award as the best player in the month-long tournament. Lloyd also tied with Germany's Celia Sasic as the top scorer at the Women's World Cup. Each had 6 goals. Sasic, though, was awarded the Golden Boot based on playing fewer minutes than Lloyd. The Golden Glove Award for top goalkeeper went to American Hope Solo. 19-year-old defender Kadisha Buchanan of host Canada won the Young Player Award, and the FIFA Fair Play Trophy went to France. In the third-place match at the Women's World Cup, England defeated Germany 1-0 in extra time in Edmonton, Canada. Farrah Williams scored on a penalty kick in the 108th minute for the 3 Lionesses of England, who had their best ever Women's World Cup showing. Meanwhile, the world champion U.S. women's national soccer team resumed its victory tour Sunday with a 2-0 victory over China in a friendly match played at University of Phoenix Stadium in the western U.S. state of Arizona. Crystal Dunn and Kristen Press had the goals for the American women, who extended their home unbeaten streak to 104 matches. That's 91 wins and 13 draws. The American girls, tough to beat on home soil. In fact, the last loss at home came in November of 2004 to Denmark. Veteran star Abby Wambach made her 254th international appearance against the Chinese when she came on in the 79th minute for Carly Lloyd. Wambach is world's all-time leading scorer in international football, male or female, with 184 goals. The USA women's team will officially bid farewell to Abby on Wednesday night when they play the final game of their victory tour in a rematch against China in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Voice of America!
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Marco Uma, joins us now with more sports news. And Mark kicks off with a victory by South Africa's rugby team in Cape Town.
Hosts South Africa beat Argentina 29-14 to triumph in the finals at the RB7 Series tournament in Cape Town on Sunday. France pipped Kenya 28-26 in the bronze medal playoff. Zimbabwe lost to Wales 21-12 in the bowl quarterfinals. Consequently, at the end of the second leg of the series, South Africa is second with 35 points, Kenya is ninth with 20 points, and Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. Turning to football, Africa's hopes for glory at the FIFA Club World Cup evaporated after the Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo succumbed to a 3-0 defeat to Japan's Sanferese Hiroshima in Osaka, Japan, on Sunday. In Senegal, Captain Peter Etebo Ogenekaro scored a brace to cancel the own goal by Odudua Segun as Nigeria edged Algeria 2-1 in the finals at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Dakar, Senegal on Sunday. Prior to the finals, South Africa edged Senegal 3-1 in a post-match penalty shootout to clinch the bronze medal. The two sides played to a scoreless draw in open play. Staying in Senegal, Nigeria, Algeria and South Africa qualify for the men's football contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. Nigeria will be playing in the tournament for the first time since the 2008 Beijing Olympics in China, where they bagged the silver medal. Algeria compete at the Olympics for the first time since 1980 in Moscow, Russia, while South Africa make their second appearance at the Games since the 2000 Sydney Olympics. Olympics in Australia.
In National Basketball Association news, the record-winning streak of the defending champion Golden State Warriors ended over the weekend at 24 games. The Warriors lost to the host Milwaukee Bucks 108-95, putting an end to the best start in NBA history. The loss came on the final stop of a 7-game road trip, and less than 24 hours after the Warriors needed two overtimes to beat the Celtics in Boston. In the words of Golden State's interim coach, Luke Walton, "We looked like we ran out of gas a little bit." While Golden State's 24-game winning streak is the best start in NBA history, the league record for wins in a row is 33, set by the Los Angeles Lakers during the 1971-72 season. Coincidentally, the Milwaukee Bucks also ended the Lakers' streak. After their 7-game road trip, the Warriors now get a chance to rest for a few days, and they'll be back on the court Wednesday night when they host the Phoenix Suns at Oracle Arena in the Northern California city of Oakland. In action Sunday, the Suns defeated the Minnesota Timberwolves 108-101. The Toronto Raptors scored their fourth consecutive victory, beating the Philadelphia 76ers 96-76. Philadelphia has the NBA's worst record, only one win and 24 losses. In Miami, Florida, the host Miami Heat edged the Memphis Grizzlies 100-97. And the host Oklahoma City Thunder rallied from a 16-point deficit to beat the Utah Jazz 104-98 in overtime. Kevin Durant scored 31 points for the Thunder. All but two of those points came after halftime. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehaeus Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC here, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a memorial to African-American slaves in New York. And next, after meeting with the heads of state of more than 50 African countries, India's prime minister discusses ways to improve the continent's health infrastructure. But first, some music. Here is J.K. Danny from Zambia with La Kasambe.
Boy, hola, wabaza sana, le mona shani, wuzikula imbafi, too much of anything is bad. Yo, we're not the
J.K. Danny from Zambia with Lakasambe. 2.5 hectares of land on Lower Manhattan Island in New York City represent brutal early American history. It's where many Africans who were slaves in homes, factories, and the city's burgeoning port are buried. In 1991, the bones of over 400 people were unearthed during construction of a federal office building. A portion of the burial ground was set aside as a monument to the slaves. The bones were reburied during a ceremony in 2003. It's now the African Burial Ground National Monument. VOA's Adam Phillips went to the memorial and spoke to some of the visitors.
On a quiet Lower Manhattan street, a stream of water symbolizing the Atlantic Ocean flows alongside a narrow boat-like structure, an echo of the ships that made their way to the New World, heavy laden with human cargo. Nearby, Juanita Jones, an elderly African-American, fixes her gaze on grassy mounds. They are the main visible reminder of the vast 17th and 18th century Negro burial ground, now the African Burial Ground National Monument.
Most of these are young people because they didn't live to be so long, because they were the ones that are hard working. You're looking down here, you see babies, infant, newborns, and all that stuff. Young people are dying like that. It's very bad.
Like Miss Jones, Mary Palmer is an African-American, born in Harlem, further north in Manhattan. She has just emerged from within the slave ship structure.
When I walked through, I felt like my heart starts jumping, because it's like I'm feeling the souls coming up to me. Like your cousin or somebody you never saw before comes up to you, and then they say, oh, hi, they touch you, and you feel something. It stirs your inner self. That's what it felt like. Somebody that was part of my family, you know, might have been. They touched me inside and shook me a little bit, so I had to lean back and hold on. You know, it was very heart-wrenching, kind of scary.
Michael Jiwa and his family are visiting New York from Nigeria. He has a sense that some of the people buried may be his ancestors and feels that his visit has offered him a bit of closure.
It's a beautiful thing to come and see where your ancestors were buried. At least, you, even though you don't see them in life, at least you know where they're buried. And like that gives you a kind of joy, like at least. Because like you always want to know where you came from, like where you originated from. If you don't know your origin, like people see you like an outcast, like nobody.
Meanwhile, Billy Williams of the Bronx, Manhattan's neighboring borough to the north, stands by the mounds, shaking his head.
I have never been much into genealogy, but I do know that I have some African ancestry. And I wonder if I was just standing on a few, you know, to look at a piece of cement that says 353 kids are buried under that is heart-wrenching to anyone. It's beyond my verbal description, you know, what I feel. The historical tragedies that have taken place over time. I'm going to make it a point to bring my grandchildren down here so they can see this important part of our history.
For Shirley Moultrie, the clean, elegant feel of the monument misrepresents the actual history of African slavery in New York, when cruelty and misery were part of everyday life.
It makes it seem like everything is okay. They just buried here. But they chained us, they beat us until we didn't even know our name. They beat us until we said massa. We was almost like animals. Whatever they say do, we did. It was like we didn't even know how to think because we were scared of the whip. We was taught sometime to hate ourselves. I think it's very sad.
Moultrie says that for African Americans, the past continues in the present, both in the racist ways they're often treated and in their own attitudes toward others.
And I think that sometimes some blacks do have the hatred for others because of this. And once we know why and how we was treated, then we can say, oh, that's why we react to certain things this way. This is why the white man might tell us something and we say, yes, sir, no, sir, because we don't know any better, you know? I wasn't raised to be prejudiced, but I'm standoffish from them, whites, or Caucasians, whatever you want to call them. But we have to learn to live beyond that.
As visitors to this place have learned, and as recent headlines have made clear, getting beyond the past can be a long, difficult, and painful ordeal. The creators of the African Burial Mound Monument hope this site can be a place to begin to discover, remember, and ultimately to heal that legacy. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met recently with the heads of state of more than 50 African countries to discuss ways to improve the continent's health infrastructure. The talks also focused on extending the reach of India's lucrative generic drug industry into Africa, where the need for low-cost medications is great, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Developing countries in Africa are battling a host of deadly infectious diseases, from diarrheal conditions to malaria to HIV. Most low-cost generic antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV have come from India. India's drug industry, which has become the world's leader in the manufacture and export of generic drugs, could fill the need for drugs for other conditions as well. The drugs cost a fraction of the originals. Exports have reaped $15 billion for the Indian economy by some estimates. But inspectors have identified factories that produce substandard drugs that are dangerous, either because they contain toxic ingredients or simply do not work. Health economist Roger Bate is with the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington-based research organization. Fake malaria drugs have already made it to Africa, and Bate worries that more copycat drugs could be on the way.
India seems to segment its markets. It sends, on average, it sends the better quality medicines to richer countries like the U.S., and the medicines that don't pass quality control, it sends to poorer nations, particularly those in Africa.
Global health consultant Gaurav Nayar confirms that poorly made and counterfeit drugs are being exported to poorer countries. Nayar says she's visited some of the sham factories, but she says knowing about the problem and doing something about it are two different things.
You can see that there's children in the market buying this counterfeit product, taking it and dying, and that's actually what inspired me to work on the problem. But it's how do you translate that into policy and action that we can actually fix it? And that's where I think this entire engine is stuck.
Nayar says samples of drugs that have made it to market have been tested for purity and effectiveness, but she says tracing bad drugs back to the source can be extremely difficult. Most generics do what they're supposed to do, and countries that import them do not want to harm anyone. But Bates says health officials in poorer nations face a dilemma.
You know, the immediate response of anyone taking the drugs is horror at that kind of, you know, a position, because they'll say, surely you should just boycott the product. The reality is that it's very difficult to do that because you end up with significant shortages.
For their part, experts say countries in Africa are also interested in getting into the business of manufacturing generic drugs, both as a way to boost their economies and get life-saving medications to their people. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Duvinsky. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.africanews.org. voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.